Back together again Friday, June 16th, 2023 on Connecticut Today. We wrapped up the week looking at President Biden's visit to Connecticut regarding gun safety laws. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso stopped by with his weekly update, while Cory Doctorow, author of Red Team Blues, a Martin Hench novel, chatted about his new book that has many real-world parallels. A Friday that finds the President of the United States, Joseph R. Biden, getting ready to deliver an address at the National Safer Communities Summit at the University of Hartford in West Hartford, about gun violence prevention here, and we will dip into that. We'll have it for you live here on WICC 600 AM, 107.3 FM, or online at WICC600.com when Mr. Biden starts to deliver his address. This has been an ongoing event. I guess it started earlier today. Governor Ned Lamont is there. Hartford Mayor Luke Bronin's comments were highlighted there. Richard Blumenthal, Chris Murphy. Chris Murphy has become one of the most prominent voices in gun violence prevention, gun laws. He kind of lashes out a lot of times at the NRA, and that's fine. I mean, come on. A Democrat getting up the back of the NRA? Gee, that's shocking, huh? Never saw that coming. Never saw that coming. So we will join in progress, as they say in the biz here, the remarks of Mr. Biden. I have been watching and reading some of the earlier stories today about this event and this National Safer Community Summit. And let me say this. I will repeat what I said yesterday, that there is no one either in my realm or myself or anybody out there, I think, who really does not want to see less gun violence. I mean, obviously, the idea of all this, in theory, is to cut down on the notion that people, if it's not in self-defense or in a time of a declared war, you want to cut down on people shooting and killing each other. And, you know, again, we feel a special hurt in this state because of what happened at the Sandy Hook Elementary School, those numerous deaths of school kids and staff members back in 2012. So this issue that has hit so hard in other countries and still other states, other countries, and still continues to hit hard here, especially has a sore point here in Connecticut. But again, and as I said yesterday, I'm looking and looking and peeling back all the layers on everybody celebrating this bipartisan gun bill that was passed in the wake of the Uvalde massacre. Again, a horrible occurrence, albeit done by somebody who clearly had issues from a broken home and was able to, I guess, buy that gun legally because there were no red flags. And as we look at all this, I'm seeing, you know, A being said, B, C, D. But again, and unless I'm missing it, and if I am, please tell me. Call me at 333-9422 or send me an email. The email is always up and running right in front of me on the computer next to me, Paul, P-A-U-L, Paul, at WICC600.com. You know, please let me know if there is any real push. And I know criminal penalties are largely handled on a state level. I get that. I understand that. Okay. There are some federal penalties, but they're few and far between. Basically, federal laws for doing stuff over state lines, gun trafficking and all that. But having said that, and we had the discussion on this yesterday, and I said, geez, let me check again. Have we ever heard anything from Senator Murphy or Senator Blumenthal, Mr. Blumenthal, or President Biden, for that matter? On making things tougher for the, and I don't want to say run-of-the-mill gun criminal. I hesitate to say that because it's an awful thing to say, But you know what I'm talking about. The shootings that get the high profile because sadly they involve long guns and most times or sometimes they're done in suburban settings, schools. It's horrible. Hotels like the one in Vegas, that's horrible at a concert. This transgender person who shot up that elementary school tragically a few months back. That's horrible too, obviously. But those are committed with long guns, and we constantly hear the constant drumbeat about, you know, rifles and AR-15s and Uzis and, you know, AK-47s and weapons of war, because, I don't know, weapons of war makes people feel good. I'm sorry. We still hear, and I looked for any of it this morning and last night, went online, poured through a bunch of stuff saying, hey, is anybody saying anything about street level violence? Street level violence, because that is where the vast majority of gun violence takes place. And I'm sorry, I'm not being partisan about this, but yeah, maybe allow me to be this time. Do we ever hear anything from the White House? Do we ever hear anything from Congress, particularly from the Democratic side? Do we ever hear really anything of members of Congress, of the White House, or whatever, telling these cities and these states, get your act together, put these gun criminals in jail for longer stretches of time? And I know everybody wants a waiting period for this and a waiting period for that. Background checks for this, and I'm all for that. I don't know how anybody could be against background checks, even if you're in the NRA, even if you're a licensed gun owner, gun retailer, you trade at gun shows, whatever. How can you be against background checks? That makes no sense. Now, I've also had experts tell me on the show that, you know, these layers of additional background checks are basically checks that are supposed to be done anyway. I don't know. I don't own a gun. I don't have plans to own a gun. At least at this point, I may in the future. Who knows? I've never sold a gun. I've never bought a gun. So I have no idea. I only hear from the people that I know that are gun enthusiasts, the men and women of all races and stripes and whatever that I know. But isn't it odd, and I say odd with tongue firmly planted in cheek, rolling my eyes, isn't it odd that we never hear, I shouldn't say never, maybe it is out there, and just because of the volume of stuff I deal with every day, I don't tend to hear it. Isn't it odd, or not, that we never really hear of anybody from Congress, especially from the Democratic side, telling mayors, local leaders, state leaders around the country, governors, get your act together. And if somebody's arrested for a gun crime and they are convicted, they need to stay in jail for a long time, maybe longer now than they are. Well, geez, Paul, you just want to put more people in jail? Well, yeah, maybe. Stop pleading down these gun cases. Stop saying, well, we'll take this instead of going to trial. No. And again, it's not just me. I mean, I read these stories to you on the air here every Monday through Friday, 2 to 6, right here. And I tell you where I'm getting the stories. And how often do I, is somewhere in that story that I'm reading to you, how often do you get a phrase like, so-and-so, comma, who is a convicted felon, comma, was found with guns, which is illegal, you think? Or so-and-so is going to jail on a case that received a plea bargain, and he'll serve 3 years and then 5 years of supervised release. No, I have an idea. How about 8 years in jail, no chance of getting out? Well, Paul, if he didn't kill anybody, I don't care. If you use a gun, see, if we're serious about gun crime, then we alter our view to take into account not only the suburban crime that tends to happen with long guns and whatever, which is horrible, But, you know, look, you have to take a look nationwide. And I know some folks don't like it. Oh, more people in jail. People do gun crime when, you know, they feel, you know, they don't have choices in life. Oh, bull crap. I'm sorry. I had a choice in life when I was growing up. And believe me, I didn't grow up in some, you know, five-star golden neighborhood. We had a nice middle-class upbringing. I never thought when I was 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 years old, here's a shock, I never thought of using a gun. See, that's the problem. We have a lot of people here, especially in the state's big cities, along with the suburban crime, that think that having a gun, like the story we read the other day at 15, 16, 17, is something that's okay. In fact, we have a leading member of the General Assembly who said a few months ago during a gun law debate, and I'm paraphrasing, well, you can't blame a lot of young African-American men for wanting to carry a gun. It's because they're scared. Really? That's where we are now. So we'll keep an eye on this gun summit here in Hartford. By the way, what are your thoughts on this? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. See, I see a lot of these proposals, this law, that law, background checks, magazines, whatever, storing gun safety storage in your home. That's all good. Nobody's going to argue that, although I think the gun safety thing in the home is ludicrous. If you're buying a gun for protection, you want it by your bed. You want it within easy reach. So I don't know where the government gets off telling somebody how to store a weapon in their own home. Now, yes, if you are a responsible gun owner and you have kids in the house, you figure out a way that the kids can't get a hold of it. You just do. There are other ways to do this. But we never hear anything about the street-level gun violence. And we even have local leaders around the state who don't like the shot spotter system that some municipalities use, including Bridgeport, to alert the cops of sounds that fall in a certain spectrum on the audio range that, hey, that may be a gunshot. I mean, you actually have people, not only here in Connecticut, but around the country who are saying, say, that's not fair. Oh, why? Because it might detect somebody who's using a gun? Listen. We are sadly nowhere near being serious about stopping gun violence. And point one would be this to me. If anybody commits a crime involving a gun, discharging a gun, shooting somebody, wounding somebody, or being in possession of that gun when by law they should not be, especially if they're a convicted felon, I'm sorry, you're in jail for years. Years. Well, that's not fair, Paul. They may not be able to see their family. I don't care, because you have to understand the only way this is going to appreciably end, because you can talk about all the long gun stuff you want. The street level gun trafficking is it's been around for years and it's not going away. You've got to put the fear of God into some people, especially when they're young, that if they're caught doing something with a gun, they might not see mom or dad or anybody for a long time. Joining us right now with his weekly wrap-up, fully confident I am that he has no classified documents still, is former Democratic State Rep Chris Caruso. Chris, you haven't been indicted on anything in the past week, have you? I'm just checking.
Not that I've noticed. I didn't get a call from my attorney or anything like that. I don't think I'm a target of this investigation, you know?
You don't think the grand jury is convening somewhere to roast you over the coals, huh?
Well, you know, anything is possible, Paul, but I haven't heard anything, you know?
All right. So, Chris,
I'll probably be the last one to know.
Well, yeah, but as long as your counsel knows, that's the important part, right?
That's why you keep them on retainer, you know?
That's right, and you have them on speed dial. Mr. Caruso, what has tweaked your interest over the past 7 days or so?
Well, I thought, you know, the whole issue around guns that you've been speaking about, and I think you've raised some good arguments, especially the street crime that we see with guns. And there was an attempt in the legislature by the chief state's attorney's office, mm-hmm. mayors from all of the cities, if you recall, legislators from the cities that I think asked the legislature to enact stricter penalties for, you know, those who have come out of prison and are you know, committing crimes. And it just so happened, I believe, when the discussions were that, you know, they felt that this would be the way to go because the majority of crimes they felt in the state, and by fact, I guess, by the data, the pertinent data, that it was being committed by people who had left, you know, who had come out of jail and on their probation had committed acts of violence with guns. And they felt that that needed to be strengthened and you know, changed in some way, maybe those sentences being longer or what have you. And apparently the legislature didn't act on it. And I thought that was troubling because when you have all the mayors of the major cities in Bridgeport, you have the chief state's attorneys involved, you know, which are the prosecutors. You have legislators from not only the cities, but also the some of the suburbs. And in addition, you had the families of victims who were, you know, people who were killed, you know, by violent acts. And they were all the chorus seemed loud enough that I really thought the legislature would have acted on that, but they didn't. So, you know, I think you've raised some relevant points, Paul.
And Chris, the mayors that we heard from on that, Joe Ganim, Justin Elliker, Luke Broen in Hartford, Neil O'Leary in Waterbury, they all said, Chris, they, in each of their cities, we're not talking about thousands of people. There is a core, you know, 200, 300, 400 that unfortunately, Chris, commit a lot of the gun violence that really casts a pall over some of these cities, and I think unfairly.
No, I agree with you. And isn't that always the case? There's a small number that, you know, makes it look bad and creates the perception of problems in the city. And it's just a small, you know, group of people. It's not certainly the majority of people in the city. And I thought, you know, they were being reasonable. They said, hey, this is the area we have to crack down on. This is the area we may have to, you know, increase penalties and jail time and so forth. And also not allow them, those folks that come out of jail, the ability to get guns. And it just fell on deaf ears. I was surprised by that. I thought that was a great opportunity, you know, coming from cities to address some of the issues with violent crimes related to guns. And I just thought it was a lost opportunity, Paul. And I thought you were fair in your argument today about that. So I wanted to speak about that.
Well, thank you, Chris. 12 past the hour, and Chris Caruso joins us, his weekly check-in. What else is on your mind, Chris, heading into this weekend?
This is how much I love you and your listeners. I'm at my nephew James' graduation from high school. He's going to UConn.
Nice.
And, I wanted to come on and talk with you guys, you know. I think, you know, there's a lot of things going on, Paul, that, you know, you've been speaking about, I think makes sense. The budget, the taxes now, I think with Ned Lamont. I was talking to folks today, Republican and Democrat, and they're really in love with this guy, you know, that he's been able to steer the ship in a certain direction. He kind of goes down the middle. The budget issues, he seems to have a handle on it well, and he seems to be navigating the ship pretty well. And I often don't hear those compliments when it comes to politicians. You know, it's always someone complaining about something they didn't do or they should do. But in this case, people seem relatively happy, which is nice to hear, you know?
Yeah, and Chris, maybe it is that the fact that the governor, prior to his election, he did, I guess, have some small positions locally, I think in and around Greenwich, maybe. And, of course, he made that U.S. Senate run, and he did win the primary back years ago. But maybe this is what you get, Chris, when you have somebody who walks in there, certainly doesn't do it for the money, and says, listen, I have some ideas, and as much as I'm on one side of the aisle or another, you've got to respect the other side, and you've got to keep people who pay tax revenue and a lot of it happy in this state.
Yeah, and, you know, the other thing, Paul, too, is that, you know, he's willing to negotiate. And what I found surprisingly positive is his ability to bring the other side, the Republican Party, to the table. And that's never easy because when you have control of the legislature, you want to kind of keep your policies and your directives. But I think it's healthy to have the other side come to the table. I don't know Senator Kelly as well as I would Vin Candelora.
Yeah.
Vin and I served in the legislature together, and I give Vin a lot of credit too, because he's a practical person. He wants to make progress. He wants resolution, and I think that's always good. And you know, both sides, the Democrats and Republicans, complained about the budget, the negotiations. Usually, when they complain, it means it was good. It actually worked. In it. Not everyone gets what they want, but I think this governor is willing to sit and work it out. And I think that bodes well for the state. It bodes well for our government. You know, today I was speaking to a person who is a Trump guy.
Okay.
And, I kind of stay away from those discussions because...
Shocking.
I get agita because for some reason I just, the oxygen's taken out of the room. And I get that. But I love this guy. So I listen. But, he said to me that he really thought Lamont has done well. And
yeah.
I think that says a lot. And I think that's what government has to be more about. I think the bipartisan approach, getting to the center of where we need to be, you're going to get people that have more trust in the government and feel that people are trying to do the right thing. Now, I know some of your callers are going to come in and they're going to have 100 reasons not to like Ned Lamont or the legislature.
Sure.
And every politician should be hung to the highest part of the poll. But the truth is, when they do something good, we have to celebrate that and acknowledge it.
And Chris, finally, you talked about him being able to bring both sides together. I often wonder, Chris Caruso, during this whole thing, of what the governor's style actually is when he's behind closed doors. Is he meek, mild Ned? Does he pound the table? Because, I don't know, and who knows, Chris, you and I have not been in there with him, but I don't think he goes to the lengths that your old pal did, Lowell Weicker, by engaging in colorful language, Caruso, when you were meeting with him.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, I love Lowell Weicker. I really do. I know people out there, what the heck you're saying? I really loved him. He did a lot for Bridgeport. But, let me tell you Ned Lamont's secret, and the people don't realize it. It's not so much banging his fist on the table or demanding anything. This guy is into relationship building.
Huh.
I've run into colleagues that are still up there and when he's in their town, he'll call them up and he'll say, hey, Representative, let's have lunch.
Wow.
Or hey, let's have dinner. I'm going to your town meeting tonight. See me there and let's talk. It's that relationship that leads to bipartisan negotiations. It leads to building. That's what politics is all about. It's that relationship building. And he's really good at that. I'll tell you, one guy from surrounding town said to me, Chris, I was at town. I was having lunch with a friend, and he calls me up and he says, "Hey, let's have dinner tonight. I'll meet you in this town, and let's break bread." And he does that both Republican and Democrat, and that's how the relationships are built. Believe me, that's what makes it work, because you get to know the other person, you put aside some of the differences, and then you're willing to negotiate and make things happen.
Great stuff. Chris Caruso, thank you. Congratulations to your family and your nephew, and we'll talk next week. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Take care now.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Yeah, there you go. See, there's something a little different about Ned Lamont. See, and I think this, and listen, I disagree with some of his stuff on the social issues, but that's the way it's going to be. But maybe this is what Chris just mentioned about Ned Lamont. Maybe that has to do with, I don't know, the fact that he ran a pretty big company, Lamont Cable Systems or something like that. Maybe he is taking his, for lack of a better word, schmoozing of possible clients. He had to get those building contracts, right? Maybe he did that, and now it's translating. Or I might be completely wrong, which I usually am. I like to entertain authors from time to time. Our next guest is regular contributor to The Guardian, Locus, many other publications, special consultant, too, to the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Now, we've had EFF guests on this program before, an MIT Media Lab research associate, visiting professor of computer science at Open University. Listen, here's another guy who's got a far better resume and business card than me. Name of the book is Red Team Blues. Corey Doctorow is the guest from the West Coast. Corey, it's Paul here in Connecticut. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for that introduction. I think the word you're looking for is an unfocused resume rather than an impressive one, but
no,
thank you.
No, come on. Every resume. What do they say, Corey? Every job's an adventure, right? And don't they tell us
definitely
that?
An adventure, for
until,
sure.
Until we see the paycheck. Hey, you have written a new book here, Red Team Blues. Now, this is a novel, right? But it's based on a character that kind of parallels stuff that's going on here. Talk about this.
Yeah, so Marty Hinch is a 67-year-old semi-retired forensic accountant who spent 40 years in Silicon Valley unwinding the weirdest, most baroque finance scams that tech bros can dream up. And he's ready to quit, but he gets called back for one last job. And it's an old pal of his who's a cryptographer from the days when crypto meant cryptography and not cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. And this guy has very unwisely decided to make his own cryptocurrency. And he's good at his job. So now it's worth more than $1 billion. But he's also just as prone as any of us to making foolish mistakes. And so he hit a back door in it that would let him rewrite the way that the money had moved around, thinking that he could use it to solve bad problems. But what's actually happened is that the keys that control that back door have gone missing. And of course, most of that $1 billion belongs to the kinds of criminal gangs who need to launder their money with cryptocurrency. And they're the kind of people who, if their money doesn't stay where they think it should, who will show up on your front door and flay you alive. And so Marty's job is to find those keys before the bad stuff happens.
Yeah, who wants to get filleted alive, right? I'm guessing. Well, last time it happened to me, it didn't work out. Now, Corey, this is paralleling stuff that could happen, is happening, might happen, First Republic Bank and all that. Tie that together for us.
Yeah, so we're in the midst of the crypto collapse. You can't help but notice it between Sam Bankman-Fried and Silicon Valley Bank and First Republic. A lot of the funny money that tech bros tried to convince us was real with things like Super Bowl ads is going poof. And, you know, this is the end of what John Kenneth Galbraith called the bezel. So the bezel is the moment in a confidence game after the confidence trickster has your money, but before you know it's a scam. And both of you feel like you're better off. And then one day, poof, it all goes missing. Marty, you know, came out to Silicon Valley because he believed that tech could be a force for good, but he's watched the finance sector play games with tech in order to just separate marks from money for so long that he's watched that dream curdle, and he's watched the potential of technology to be a force for human liberation turn into the reality of technology as a source of surveillance, control, manipulation, and extraction. And, you know, I think that's what we're seeing as the crypto collapse happens, is that these people who are supposed to be the smartest guys in the room, who are supposed to be the people we look to define the future, have actually just turned around and either been marks in a confidence game or actually been in on the confidence game.
Author Corey Doctorow is the guest. Name of the book is Red Team Blues, a Martin Hinch novel that kind of weaves into real-life stuff going on here. As Corey mentioned, the cryptocurrency meltdown and some of these crypto exchanges, high-tech, Sam Bankman-Fried, who's still in the middle of all this. Corey, in your novel and in real life, who's watching the hen house here? I hope it's not the fox and all these things. What happens in the novel, and does that parallel what's going on in real life here?
Well, you know, the novel has got its share of G-men in it. You know, as the keys to this back door get recovered, Marty finds himself in between warring gangs of, on the one hand, narco-terrorists, and on the other hand, ruthless Eastern European money launderers. And the U.S. three-letter agencies that are supposed to be helping actually are more interested in covering their own asses than helping Marty out, even if that means throwing him under the bus. When you look at what's going on in the real world, we actually are seeing finally a little bit of regulation in the crypto space between Gary Gensler and the commodities regulator. So Gensler's at the SEC. We're actually seeing indictments coming down that if they're successful, would really put the largest crypto exchanges out of business. They're reclassifying finally classifying the most commonly traded crypto securities as securities, which would mean that all these people would have to be dealer brokers and they wouldn't be allowed to be in these conflicts of interest where they trade against their own customers and so on. you know, whether they're able to continue to operate offshore, I think remains to be seen. But, you know, if these guys can't use American customers, they're not going to have a business because all the money for this scam is coming from the U.S.
Who's the worst to deal with, the Eastern European gangs or the other thugs that you would mention there? Because I'm saying to myself, one or the other. I'm not too sure here who I want to invite to lunch.
Well, you're getting at the title of the book. So the reason the book's called Red Team Blues, it's a reference to red teams and blue teams in security exercises. Uh-huh. So in military training and then later on in strategy games and finally in information security, the team that defends is the blue team and the team that attacks is the red team. It takes a really different temperament to play each team. You know, to be blue, to defend, you have to make no mistakes. But to be red and attack, you just have to find one mistake the blue team made and exploit it. And Marty's always been on the red team. All he does is he looks at the spreadsheets that these guys who think they're the smartest guys in the world have put together to hide their money, and he uses those same spreadsheets to find it. When Marty has to go underground and run away from these two warring gangs, that's the point at which he has to switch to the blue team, and he hates it. And so the whole second half of the book is about Marty figuring out how to turn the tables, how to go from being a defender to being an attacker in order to play to his strengths. And so much of the time in information security, that's the core mission, right? It's to move from being the defending team where what you're doing is just trying to make no mistakes and trying to be reactive to becoming the attackers and actually figuring out who's coming after you and getting them before they can get you.
Any parallels, Corey, in this book, say, between guys you mentioned here, of course, Mark Zuckerberg from Meta, Jeff Bezos, oh, wait, I got another package, and Elon Musk, supervillains or not? Parallels here or not?
Well, you know, I think the thing that Marty has going for him is having spent 40 years, he knows that these guys are neither supervillains nor superheroes, that they're not super anything. They're people who got lucky, who are in the right time, right place at the right time, who are able to use their unlimited access to the capital markets to buy all their competitors and then declare themselves to be geniuses who outcompeted everyone. I mean, you think about Google, this is a company that made one successful in-house product, a search engine, and then they threw together some old Safari code to make Chrome. They cloned Hotmail to make Gmail. Everything else they made in-house failed. And everything that they've done that's successful is a company that they bought, right? Whether that's their video or their ads or their mobile operating system, even server management, calendaring, maps, you know, you name it. It's a startup they bought from someone else. They want you to think that they're Willy Wonka's idea factory, but they're really just people with a big fat wallet who just buys everyone who's got a good idea. You know, they spend $45 billion a year. That's a whole Twitter every year, original value, not Musk knockdown value, on just having these exclusivity deals so that whenever you search, no matter what tool you're using, what operating system, that you're defaulting to searching with Google. And that keeps anyone from even trying to start a rival search engine.
Well, it's almost like Apple, too, Corey. I mean, look, Apple's worth a gazillion dollars, you know. But when you look back at the stuff they've done, they didn't invent the MP3 player. They didn't invent the smartphone. There's a lot of stuff in computering that they didn't invent. But as you say, with Google, it's like, let's see what we can mop up here off the floor, and let's take ideas that other people had, and let's just make them really slick and really expensive.
Well, and, you know, they buy 90 companies a year at Apple. They shop for companies more often than you and I shop for groceries. You know, this is true across the board. These companies are mostly interested in their access to the capital markets, not in great ideas. And this wasn't always the case, right? In the early years of Marty's life and in the early years of our world before the Reagan Revolution, companies had to grow by competing, not by buying their competitors. And it was the changes to antitrust law under Reagan that produced this world where, as Tom Eastman says, the web is five giant websites filled with screenshots of text from the other four. It's also produced the world in which radio is all owned by one company, and so is ticketing, and so is, you know, we have five publishers, four studios, three labels, two ad tech companies, and one company that controls all the ebooks and audiobooks. And we wonder why creators are getting paid less and why giving them more copyright isn't helping. Well, if you've got to sell your work and into a market with only five firms or four or three or two or one, getting extra copyright to sell to them is like getting extra lunch money from your parents when you're getting bullied for your lunch money every day. Doesn't matter how much lunch money your parents give you, the bullies are going to take it all. In fact, if you get enough, they might run a international campaign saying, won't someone think of the hungry kids, give them even more lunch money.
The name of the book is Red Team Blues, a Martin Henschen novel, as we like to say in movie land, snatched from today's headlines. Cory Doctorow is the guest. Cory, thanks. And before I let you go, who's playing Martin Henschen in the movie? Have you thought about that?
Oh, I think it's a Nicholas Nolte kind of figure for sure.
Really? Nick Nolte?
Yeah.
Well, because he's been around, he needs that weathered look.
Yeah. He's a 67-year-old, right? I mean, he's out there fighting crime, but he also can't sleep for more than three consecutive hours without getting up to pee. So, you know.
Yes, and by the way, know the feeling. Hey, Cory, thanks. Take care, and we'll be in touch. Thank you.
All right, nice talking to you.
Thanks, bye-bye. All right, so Nick Nolte is going to play, I'm just kidding, but you never know. Listen, I've interviewed guys who've had their movies or their novels made into movies. Cory Doctorow, Red Team Blues, a Martin Henschen novel, who's on one team, then he's on the other team. And so he's already wondering, Nick Nolte, how about that? We haven't heard a lot from him.